Welcome again, dear listeners, to Food Conversations, Season 6. We must, of course, never forget that we are living and working on Squamakulu, the ancestral, unceded, and actually stolen lands of the Squamak people. It's obvious that doing everything we can to resolve this situation is an important and necessary responsibility for every one of us. Now, my guest today on Food Conversations is someone who has a great deal to share with us about our relationship with food, and not just the life forms we eat, but all other life forms as well. He does so from an ancient perspective, but one that has critical implications for all our lives today and in the future. Dr. Keith Williams is an educator with deep personal and academic roots in North American indigenous culture. He recently became an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University, and he's also the director of research and social innovation at First Nations Technical Institute, located on Tiendanaga Mohawk Territory. But that academic description doesn't really capture what an informed, thoughtful, and insightful person Keith is, as you're going to find out today. So without further ado, Keith, let me warmly welcome you to Food Conversations.
Thank you so much, Warren. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, it's interesting what here means today, because it's worth mentioning that you're living in Nova Scotia on the other side of this continent, and we're able to converse because of modern technology that allows us to connect directly across vast distances, almost as if we were in the same room. So I want listeners to be clear that talking about ancient doesn't mean one cannot simultaneously embrace the latest in technological innovations. Now, Keith, when we spoke a couple of days ago, you made reference to Wade Davis, the famous Canadian anthropologist and author, and you recalled a quote about someone living in Wall Street versus an Indigenous person in a village. Can you remember the gist of what that quote was all about? Not the words exactly, but the gist.
Sure, Warren. That was from a CBC Ideas broadcast from possibly a decade or more ago, actually more like 20 years ago. So my memory of what happened yesterday is fuzzy, and my memory of, you know, what happened 20 years ago is even fuzzier. But it went something like this. You know, I think Wade was looking at quality of life and also, you know, who's basically asking the question, you know, who's civilized here, you know, because in the Western world, there are so many tropes that cast Indigenous peoples as primitive and backwards. And really, you know, he was comparing the Wall Street banker or financier with you know, who spends probably most of their time in business meetings, you know, working 70, 80 hours a week, you know, with an Indigenous Amazonian person who, you know, from his lived experience with those tribal communities, spends much of their time with their family members and friends, hunting, gathering food, crafting items, and just living their lives. And you know, he really asked, you know, I think he asked the listener at that point, who's more civilized, who has a better quality of life? And the answer was obvious, you know, it was the person in the Amazon. And yes. I totally concur, you know.
People flee Wall Street from time to time, but people rarely flee from the Amazon rainforest. They try and say, people, if you're coming here, please be nice. I actually looked around for another quotation from Wade Davis, because I was intrigued by what he said, but the sense of what you've just said, I think, is really critical to what we're going to be talking about today. And this is a quote that I found, and it is as follows. Cultural survival is not about preservation, sequestering Indigenous peoples in enclaves like some sort of zoological specimens. Change itself does not destroy a culture. All societies are constantly evolving. Indeed, a culture survives when it has enough confidence in its past and enough say in its future to maintain its spirit and essence through all the changes it will inevitably undergo. And it seems to me that what we're going to be talking about is cultural transformation. And the transformation that I think is essential, and more people recognize it, as essential to our survival, is a return to the indigenous way of connecting to the natural world, a kind of rehabilitation of Western extractivist capitalism. Now, there's a lot of words. Could you please reflect, respond and reflect on my comments or these comments?
Well, sure. I would love to, Warren. You know, and there's so much, I mean, there's so much to say about that topic. You know, the first thing that comes to mind is a Haudenosaunee teaching, and that's around containment. And and the idea is that, life and the vital life force that animates creation, and in the Mohawk language that would translate as gasat sentra, that must be allowed to circulate. We must do what we can to ensure that vital life force circulates. And as soon as we contain or enclose things or persons, we essentially kill them. And I think, whether that's, water in bottles or people in prisons or people in reserves or reservations, if you're in the United States. So I think there's something really profound there. There's a profound teaching underneath all of that. And I remember, I don't know if this is the time to bring this up, but I remember years ago when I was a boy, I was a young man, maybe a heavily influenced by the Whole Earth Review, which was a spinoff of the Whole Earth Catalog. Mm-hmm. And I remember reading an article, sometime in the late 90s, about cultural survival. And basically the idea was that cultures that adapt cultures that are dynamic are the ones that survive. And as soon as we try to lock cultural mores down, that's kind of can lead to a slow death. I think there's some really interesting stuff to dig into there.
That reminds me of a story of a young Mohawk woman who went to a reenactment site in Germany, where all the local German people were running around wearing loincloths and carrying spears and things like that. And she came wearing spandex and having her cell phone in her hand. And she came up and said, "Hi, I like to say hi." And they said, "Hello, who are you?" And she said, "Well, I'm an indigenous person, and I've come to visit you and see what you do." And they were horrified. They said, "But you can't be indigenous because you have a cell phone and you're wearing spandex, pants and bright shiny colors. That's not indigenous." And they were unable to free themselves from their narrow vision of what indigenous people were like. That's a perfect example of what I think you were saying.
Oh, I would say so too. And I've heard about these anachronistic recreative villages in Germany and possibly even beyond, and it's quite remarkable. And I think bringing that up is in this context is very interesting because it illustrates or reveals this what I would describe as a Western tendency to fixity, to fix things in identity categories. And I think that's it's a dangerous trend, I would say, because it leaves little room for authentic expression of contemporary responses to an already dynamic and changing world.
Absolutely. It's astonishing how narrow that can be.
Yeah.
When we're talking, you also pointed out that indigenous languages are filled with verbs, and English is the epitome of a language in which there are names for things. Maybe you could just comment on that a little bit, because that's such an essential principle in terms of this movement and change and fluidity of energy concept.
Yeah, I would say so as well. And from my limited understanding, English as a language is primarily noun-based, and that lends itself to the creation and maintenance of these stable identity categories. Whereas many of the indigenous languages of Turtle Island are verb-based, and it's the action that's happening is that's kind of the focus of the that grammatical construction. And I think we might have even briefly touched on Gerald Weisner's notion of indigenous transmotion. And he's an Anishinaabe fellow from White Earth Reservation, same reservation as Winona LaDuke. And it's a beautiful idea, and I think it really encapsulates this kind of like natural movement in the world. And so if any of your listeners have a chance to look up Gerald Weisner transmotion, it's a beautiful concept, and I think we can all benefit from that in our lives, really.
To aid readers, why don't you spell Weisner?
V-I-Z-E-N-O-R.
V-I-Z-E-N-O-R. All right, yeah. Listeners, you have your homework for today. And it's an action, not a name.
That's right. Yeah. You won't be disappointed.
There we are. Encouragement thrown in for free. Well, let's segue a little bit and down to the earth, of which we are all derivative, because your early years were spent in a very earthy part of the world and in a very earthy relationship with the world. In Nova Scotia, born and raised in Nova Scotia, in a little town called Shelburne. It's expanded from the time when you were there from 1,400 to a total of now 1,600 people.
Ooh.
It's a big, big change. And your father had indigenous connections that were there from the beginning, including, we'll be talking about later, about Tiendanaga from southeastern Ontario. But he was adopted after his mother died. And this led to some a mixing that's so common in so many people who are attached to an indigenous lineage. Why don't you talk about Scotland, Mohawk, Nova Scotia, that mixture?
Yeah, I mean, sure. You know, when growing up in rural Nova Scotia, you know, my mother's family is Scottish. She was born in Scotland, and they moved to Canada and ultimately to Nova Scotia after World War II. And so, I think, you know, for many people in their families, it's the maternal lineage that tends to, you know, this is the kind of the conduit through which culture is typically transferred.
Indeed.
You know, and much of that is through food. Actually,
yes,
and
makes
and
me immediately so, think of Black culture in the United States and the maternal food relationship.
Oh, no question. Yeah, absolutely, and that's rich. And so, you know, for us, it was, you know, it was that Scottish connection, and you know, we didn't really, I mean, growing up, we didn't really have much connection to Dad's family at all, you know, and very little.
But indigeneity was always there, was it not? Always a presence.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways, you could say that in that we, you know, we had a really rich life that was full of time outdoors, time in the garden, time out berry picking in the bogs and in the woods and gathering mushrooms, and so you know those activities that were in relation with the beings we call food, you know, that permeated life growing up.
Now, as I recall, there was a park near where you lived, and the park was one of the places you would go to and do the berry picking, and specifically harvesting mushrooms. And we're going to talk about that later, because that's sort of an iconic life form that has played a role in your life and probably a lot of people's lives that they're not aware of, how important it is. But there were things like dulse, which is a form of seaweed. Occasionally, your neighbors would have a deer carcass on the go. Clam digging, and there was an old homestead that where somebody had grown Concord grapes. And you went
yes.
and harvested them. You harvested this non-indigenous food with great pleasure.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think in a way that's also part of, from my, you know, my understanding, that's also part of what it means to be, you know, to be indigenous too, is to a place is not just enjoying, you know, those foods that are traditional and maintaining those relationships and that gratitude for our traditional foods, but also interacting with the changing landscape.
And, indeed. And such an important point about separating tradition that is based on land as it was and developing and encouraging traditions about land as it now is. Now, you were very involved with, and it's still part of your life, with earthy activities. But it's also true, pardon me, you went off into educational studies.
Yes.
And an academic career. Now, why did you do an academic career? It's not something that every child in a small village.
Yeah, not at all. That's a good point, Warren. And you know, I think for myself, both of my parents were trained teachers, so I think that probably played a role. My father was the first person to receive a university education in his family. He grew up in a foster home, and for a child of the, 40s and 50s to go to university, from a foster home, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. So I think there was a real value, that was valued in the home. Not only that, I mean, Nova Scotia is chronically poverty stricken and has been, and especially the South Shore, and at least that part of the South Shore. Mm-hmm. You get further up, there's quite a bit of wealth from American vacationers, so I think there was this sense that in order to have a viable life and a livelihood, this was the way to do it,
And not surprisingly, your first degree was to do with food, agriculture.
Yes.
What did you focus on bringing this child of berry picking and mushroom harvesting? What did you aim for when you did that first degree?
I was really interested in plants. That was my main interest. And through that degree, I mean, even before, I was interested in foods. But at that time, I would say I didn't have a real sense that, community-based food revitalization projects or community development projects around food could be a thing. Mm-hmm. But I kind of quickly, I think it was probably into my second year that I started getting turned on to that. And at that time, I mean, now that's a mainstay of food sovereignty and food justice mm-hmm. conversations.
Absolutely.
But at that time, nobody was talking about that. And I remember, at the time, one of my best friends, Davey Hartley, who was an African Nova Scotian, a Black Nova Scotian, and community developer, we had all these big dreams about putting together like traditional canning workshops and berry picking and all kinds of stuff. And we never realized that together, but I certainly did those things in the future. And I often think back to those days and wish I could talk to him about it and revisit those early ideas.
Well, you were already translating the academic principles into practical projects in your mind, which it seems to me is an essential process. It has to happen
yeah.
at some point. Did you, when you got your degree, which is something that happens at Western institutions, you have a piece of paper you walk away with. What would you say you took away when you left the program and moved on?
At the time, I think that's the point at which my interest in sacred plant medicines and psychedelics really galvanized, and I realized that that was a path that I probably wanted to consider and follow. And so that led me to do a master's degree in mycology
connection.
Exactly. Yeah. But not only that, but also, as a child, I was really fascinated with mushrooms. So mm-hmm. I had this inherent appreciation of their, their form and beauty.
And suddenly their appearance. One minute
exactly.
They don't appear to be there, and then they're all over the place.
Yes.
It's interesting, too, because mushrooms embody what I would see as, and there are probably many more, but three basic things. One is that they are a food source. Another is that they are a source of medicine, an actual, medicine for treating illnesses. And the third thing, of course, is what you've mentioned, that they are sort of a source of psychoactive compounds, which can have a powerful influence on human consciousness. And we're going to talk more about that because I think it's of the mushroom, if you like, embodies these this multiplicity of characteristics, which is something that all foods probably have as well, but it's particularly unique to mushrooms. And we're, and of course, Western science is just kind of getting a grip on how important fungi of all sorts are. I'm thinking of the work of Suzanne Simard, which was quite astonishing for the Western scientific world to understand that there was a relationship in the ground between life forms mediated by these almost invisible qualities, these invisible appurtenances of mushrooms, these long, kilometers long even, sometimes hyphae that extend, these little branching arms that extend through the soil. And it's really enlivening a lot of conversations now about how we relate to the world. Now, that wasn't the end of your education. You went on to do a PhD at St. Francis Xavier University in educational studies. Now, educational studies is where, obviously, you synthesize a lot of things and you relate them to others. What was going on in your thinking about things at that time?
Well, you know, a couple of things. I mean, one is that I'd worked for so long in my career as an educational, like as a faculty member and as an administrator in the community college system. So it seemed like an obvious choice. But I also feel, you know, that there's, I think earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the importance of translating research into practical or applied solutions for community problems. Indeed. I think you were maybe alluding to that.
Yes.
And, you know, I think education is a really, like, it's a profound medium for want of a better way to express it, intergenerational knowledge transfer. So that was, you know, that was part of it. And also, maybe this sounds a little bit obscure, but I was quite intrigued by the Amazonian indigenous notion of plant teachers. Ayahuasca, the ayahuasca concoction and the different plants that are used are called plant teachers. Mm-hmm. And they tell people things. And, you know, and we have the same thing in the Haudenosaunee world, and you can find that all over indigenous Americas. Mm-hmm. In which plants, not necessarily psychoactive plants, in some cases blueberries, mm-hmm. or devil's club. Mm-hmm. They serve as these instructive or tutelary, roles. They play these roles in our lives. Indeed. So I thought that was very interesting.
I'd remind the listeners once again that I'm speaking with Keith Williams, who is an assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. And we're going to talk about Athabasca University in a moment. It's a very unique institution. One of the things that was written about you under the heading of your PhD and what you were aiming for was, and You described this as well. Your research was aimed at helping us all be better relatives to each other and to the more than human. And then in brackets was all our relations. All our relations, of course, is a well-known phrase that's used so often in indigenous circles to acknowledge this interconnection that we have with other life forms. And then the next step was to share these understandings with other people. Would that be an accurate summation of the motivation behind this process of going formally into education studies and work?
Yeah, you know, I would say so, Warren. And not only that, but I would say that those questions, those two points that you brought up, I mean, that really describes my, I would say, you know, my life's purpose.
Modus vivendi.
Yes, exactly. No, it really is. I mean, this is what matters to me.
The university that you are now affiliated with, I remember when I went to the website, I couldn't find a geographical location. And it's interesting, a lot of corporate players do exactly that. They never tell you where they are. They just say, we do wonderful things and believe in us and love us. But when I went to good old Wikipedia and found out what was really going on, it's really quite a fascinating story. Athabasca University, there were three universities in Alberta. This was number four. The University of Alberta didn't want another one in Edmonton, which is where the original site was supposed to be. So it went north 145 kilometers to Athabasca Landing, as it was called. That was the settler term. But previously, it had been a meeting place and a training place for indigenous people for, you know, thousands of years. And it was founded in 1970 and based on the principle of distance learning. Back when in the world of mimeographs and letters mailed to people and that kind of thing. What was it about Athabasca University that drew you into this unique institution?
Well, I would say a few things. One is that I really believe in the kind of the democratizing element of the access inherent in most online learning environments, and I would say Athabasca exemplifies that. So that really means a lot to me. Also in terms of my own personal life, I love living in, you know, this little rural village. I go in the summertime, I go swimming every day in the Atlantic Ocean, and I don't want to give that up.
I wanted to put that on your CV. Swims the Atlantic Ocean every day. That's a great qualification for being attached to planet Earth.
Yeah, right from, I think I started in mid-June and stopped on October 20th. That was my, I missed 3 days because of tropical storms tropical storms, actually.
Yes, I think you can be forgiven for those hiatuses. There's another feature about Athabasca University I think is really central, and I wonder, I'd like to invite your comments. First of all, in 2001, it established what it initially called the Center for World Indigenous Knowledge and Research. What a grand and glorious title. It's now called Nukshkatawin, which is a name meaning the meeting place. And that name was chosen by an elder. Now, I don't know which elder, because it says on the website, it says chosen by our elder. And I immediately thought of Maria Campbell, who is a famous Indigenous author. Do you have any insight into that secret elder person?
You know, I'm sorry. I wish I did, but I've only been there for about 6 months now, so I'm still learning things. I probably will be for quite some time.
So we'll give you a homework assignment to find out who that elder was.
I will.
The principle behind this Nukshkatawin is the goal was and still is the acknowledgement and development of traditional Indigenous knowledge in the academic circles, and to support, protect, and preserve Indigenous knowledge, education, and oral tradition. Again, a grand goal, but also, as I said at the beginning, something that's critical for all of us to be doing. Why didn't you give some reflections on that? Because I think that's a central principle.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I think it's... In that way, I see Athabasca working towards, our collective responsibility of addressing the Truth and Reconciliation recommendations. And I think every university, in my opinion, and college, every higher learning institution, to take seriously the fact that, you know, we're on Indigenous land here, and Indigenous people have been marginalized largely through the field of education, and through education, we can perhaps look at healing some of those wounds. And, it's a tricky one too, though. All of this is quite tricky because, I think, there is a question in my mind, and that's, can mainstream institutions, non-Indigenous institutions, ever fully decolonize or fully indigenize? And really, I think the answer is no. And so what does that mean for those institutions? And then what is their mandate and their responsibility? And I think really firstly, I think that mainstream institutions need to do whatever they can to support Indigenous run community-based higher education institutes.
So what would your second point be,
Keith? So firstly, it's very important that, at post-secondary, mainstream post-secondary institutions do what they can to support the beleaguered and underfunded Indigenous institutes that exist right from BC to Ontario. And secondly, I think that, there's a tension there, though, and there is a very important role for mainstream universities to decolonize and indigenize, but I think we need to be clear about what the role of those institutions is versus the Indigenous-run institutes and the scope. Because I guess one thing I fear is that we're going to see going into the future is as resources become increasingly scarce due to a number of factors. I'm concerned that Indigenous institutes will be competing for the same money against mainstream institutions, and I don't know, that's a concern, I suppose.
You know, one interesting feature of university used to be that professors would leave the groves of academe and go out in the case of agriculture in particular, and go out and stand in the field with a farmer. And it seems to me that's within the settler community, more or less. But it seems to me that notion, building on what you just said, is that collaboration outside the world of academics and getting on the ground, what you said earlier and what we talked about earlier about the earth and connecting to the earth, yeah, as opposed to just staying in the room where all the theories are viable, whether they actually work or not.
Yeah, well, I think that's a very important insight. And if you look at, existence from an Indigenous perspective versus a Western perspective, in the Western world, our existence is basically ascribed to logos or reason, the word. In the Indigenous world, as Robert Warrior talks about, the Osage scholar talks about, existence is predicated on land or topos, territory. Mm-hmm. And so really, if that's the source of everything, it's imperative that we get back to the source if we're going to, ground any of our decisions in anything real.
Right.
But I see we're getting so far away from that, with all the screen time and increasingly these electronic worlds that bear little resemblance to what's right outside the window or the door.
It's astonishing how we have transmogrified the world around us into visual images that have so little to do often with the actual behavior of the land and all the living appurtenances there too. Now, you're also involved with another institution that I think is also playing a role in exactly what you're describing, the First Nations Technical Institute, which is on the Tiendanaga Mohawk territory in southeastern Ontario, a little east of Belleville. Mm-hmm. And there, obviously, there's some family connections. You have some family connections to that part of the world. Mm-hmm. But your description there as your sort of academic place in that is that you're interested in rediscovering a kind of continental citizenship by cultivating intimate intrapersonal relationships with the food and medicine plants of Turtle Island, the traditional name, indigenous name for the earth. Could you compare and contrast your statements to this is an academic, non-academic exercise.
Yeah.
First of all, this notion of a continental citizenship. What a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and I believe that I got that expression from Dan Longboat, who's an elder, and I would describe Dan as a mentor and friend, and he's just a brilliant guy. I think so highly of him, and every time I speak with him, my mind is blown. But I think we're all here on this continent, and what makes us up, who we are, it's influenced, intimately influenced, profoundly influenced by the tides, by the moon cycles, by the foods that I eat, by the smell of the leaves on the forest floor in the fall, like all of these things, by the tracks in the snow. I saw some skunk tracks the other day, and they were just amazing. I just love those. I know why they have those scent glands. They're just so adorable. If they didn't, we'd all take them home.
Or have them live under your house and drop by and visit once in a while.
That sounds okay. I do have a friend, a good friend of mine, who's Cherokee, and she lives in upstate New York, and she has a skunk that lives under her tiny home.
That's a wonderful idea. What a wonderful idea. And you know, if you have a good relationship with a skunk doesn't have to spray, because skunk is happy to have you around. Talk about intimate intrapersonal relationships.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting that you picked up on that. Mm. And thank you. You know, that the inspiration for that word comes from the New Materialist writings, and that would be like Karen Barad and some of those other folks. And so their idea is that, you know, we live in a vibrant world populated by animate matter. And so this idea of intraactivity or intraaction is that really the difference between you and I, or me and my food, or me and this cup of coffee that I'm enjoying right now is academic in the term. It's in a way it's irrelevant because our personhood extends beyond the confines of our bodies, mm-hmm. and it includes everything that we interact with. So that intra suggests that, you know, it's all inside, you know, even if it's outside.
Yes, indeed. The barriers and the boundaries are, they have a functional role, but they don't have an existential role. They're not defining us as limited.
Well said. Yeah.
You can quote me. I forget.
I forget what I said.
I remember what I said. Now, also, I first heard about you and your work when I contacted the editors of a journal that I get the printouts, the postings regularly from. It's a wonderful journal called the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. And the reason why I think it's so wonderful is because it looks at the big picture by talking about the individual pictures and putting them together as an aggregate. Now, there you were the co-chair of the journal's shareholder consortium. Now, shareholder has a funny meaning in Western history. It means you put a little money down and somebody goes off and makes a lot of money and brings you back more money, usually by exploitative colonial extractivism. Mm-hmm. But in this case, I don't think that's what it meant. The shareholder consortium was a very different thing. What was your role there?
Just basically coordinated our meeting, our annual meeting, and helped with a few important items. I think we drafted an equity agenda, a Black Lives Matter statement, and we also instituted an Indigenous Food Sovereignty editorial circle that I'm now the chair of, and it's been a real pleasure actually to work on that circle or with that circle of folks.
Why don't you describe the journal? Because the journal is a nexus for all sorts of wonderful ideas. The editor himself, Duncan Hilchey. Why don't you let people know a little bit about that? Because it's quite interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And you know, it's from my understanding, this journal is purpose is to bring together academics, community members, advocates, anyone working in you know, the so-called food space, to basically share the results of their applied research. And so, of course, because it's a journal and, you know, you have to write articles, it selects for academics, like it preferentially selects for academics, but there's still a role there for community members and activists to share their stories about the good food work. What I find particularly inspiring about this journal, you know, it's open access, and it's open access because they adopted this funding model based on CSA, like community food, community food baskets.
Yes.
So all of those the members of the shareholder consortium, I think consortium is another strange word too. It sounds like a mob,
yes.
But, you know, but they're not like that at all.
They're good people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm. I can't speak highly enough of Duncan and Amy. They're lovely people with such a vision. And they've actualized that. And so, so basically all of these shareholders contribute a certain amount of money. And then that money allows the journal to publish articles open access. And the thing that's really beautiful about it too is that Indigenous organizations and Black organizations don't have to pay membership fees.
What, you know, I would also comment that the research that I've looked at is always involving reaching out into a community. It's never, you know, we have a theory and this is what the theory is and this is the way it is. It's more like we had an idea. We talked to some people. We went out and saw what they did and we saw that they were doing this and the effect was that. It seems to me it's very empirical in a broad sense.
Oh, yeah.
I'll remind again listeners that I'm talking with Keith Williams, who's assistant professor of educational studies at Athabasca University. And now, of course, you've learned that he's also director of research and social innovation at First Nations Technical Institute. And he was also a shareholder consortium chair at the Journal of Agriculture, Food Systems, and Community Development. Now, I'd like to come back in a moment to the topic of mushrooms, which much of your academic work and also your understanding of kind of food and indigenous attitudes and understanding about food is tied to. But there's one other institution I just want to mention, and it's one that you have a bit of an indirect tie to. The executive director of the Yellowhead Institute is Dr. Right. Hayden King, and he was also involved with the First Nations Technical Institute to some degree. But the Yellowhead Institute is doing some of the things that we've been talking about, bringing forward accurate, truthful information about the experience of Indigenous people in Canada and in North America. And it's part of the Toronto Metropolitan University, which used to be called Ryerson University. And the name was changed for very good reasons. And I wonder if you could just, from what you've seen and experienced, just comment a little bit on that transformational process going on within the academic world, because that's what we've been talking about.
Sure. And so do you mean the transformational process in terms of that, like that renaming of Ryerson, for example?
The name change and then the establishment of the Yellowhead Institute itself, which is named after an Indigenous chief and powerful.
Yeah. Who I believe, if I'm not, I could be mistaken, but I believe he was a Mohawk as well, who ended up in Alberta.
Ah, well, certainly the continental approach to Indigenous values would allow him to travel anywhere. But it's going in the Yellowhead Institute is very powerful in its statements about the mistreatment and enumerates how that mistreatment has been experience in practical ways, in financial ways, even terms of colonialism and how it's had an impact.
I highly recommend the Yellowhead Institute. You know, I visit their website probably once a month, actually, because they're briefs. Like they produce these briefs, and they're you know, I guess sometimes I just feel like the depth of coverage of some of these really complex and important issues, it's just not there in the mainstream media. And so I rely on people at the Yellowhead Institute to give me the facts, you know, because they're on it. And it's like, similarly, I tend to go to Al Jazeera if I want, or BBC if I want good world news.
Indeed. Both so, well known. Yes,
yeah.
Indeed.
You know, that transformation that you referred to, is there time to talk about that, or should we
absolutely
move on to
the next? Well, I was going to talk about it in the context of mushrooms
okay.
and fungi and this sort of invisible element, we would say, up until the day when they suddenly pop up all over the place.
Yeah.
This invisible life form most of the time, and the fact that it's food, medicine, and has also these compounds that, as you say, allow mushrooms to be teachers.
Yeah.
And in terms of the whole context that we're talking about of transforming Western science, Western attitudes, Western understanding back to a rehabilitation, taking it back to an understanding that has been excluded from Western industrial society for far too long and is leading us down a very dangerous path. There, how's that for an intro?
Yes, you got it. You nailed it. Absolutely.
I don't even like the idea of nailing. I have an image of hammering a piece of metal into a board. But I'll accept that.
Pardon the violent illusion. It is a bit. Yeah.
So, could you just elaborate on the notion of transformation as you see it taking place, and how necessary it is?
Well, if I understand the question correctly, I guess what I'm seeing, especially, for example, in the so-called psychedelic renaissance, mm-hmm. is that so many people that I know and have run into are increasingly interested in understanding their own culture's land-based spirituality. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, that's really heartening. I find that very heartening. And I know, of course, there are red flags as well. And I think we have to be aware that, you know, the adoption of some anachronistic, long lost cultural, you know, cultural animistic practice doesn't elide, you know, the knowledge that's been created and maintained here on Turtle Island for millennia. Because I think, you know, we're not in Europe. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, while that may be part of some people's heritage and it's important to embrace that, it's also important to recognize that, you know, as my friend Dan Longboat says, you know, there is a spirit language in the land here, and you know, it doesn't speak the European languages. So I think, you know, there's a tension there. So that's one cautionary flag. Another one is that I think, from what I understand, there's a rise in right-wing extremism that also is accompanied by this valorization of actually Norse mythology, much of which is anachronistic. Mm. So I think there's a couple of cautionary tales there, or cautionary notes. But generally, I feel like it's a very I'm hopeful that particular trend will lead many of us here on Turtle Island, who are disconnected from place and disconnected from our ancestral roots and knowledge, back to that.
It's interesting. A lot of people don't realize that the Norse were great farmers and that they had an excellent relationship with the land. It's just that they went Viking and wandered around and slaughtered a bit here and there. You sent me a paper. You sent me a paper that, it seems to me, summarizes some of this disconnect between the way Western industrial capitalist society has been going, which we all know is creating things like unquenchable pollution, extreme weather events, a warming planet, warming at an extraordinarily rapid rate. And the paper you sent me was by an academic named Nies Devenot, and Nies, the letter S in her word has a little cedilla underneath, that little wiggly thing.
Yeah.
And I believe it's a Turkic language word. But at any rate, in that article, there was a quotation that I think is quite relevant to what we're talking about now, and really exemplifies and focuses on the problems when you put an extractivist economy and all the ideas behind it next door to a community-based model and one that is grounded in the land. So what she says is, using psychedelics to treat individual symptoms rather than calling for societal reorganization, the medicalization of psychedelics is repeating the same neoliberal for-profit approach to healthcare that contributed to the poor outcomes of Prozac and other of the SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And it seems to me that encapsulates this kind of conflict between two ways of looking at the world. One is, a tree is dimensional lumber waiting to be harvested and converted into boards and sold. And another that sees a tree as an energy vehicle that has, as you said earlier, a teaching for us to learn from. Could you comment on that fraught interface between these two worldviews?
Sure. And you know, my colleague Neshe Devenot, she is brilliant. She is just brilliant, and that paper is too. And she's part of this group called Symposia, P-S-Y-M-P.
Yes, P-S-Y. With a P at the beginning. Yes.
Thank you. Yes, Symposia, and they're if anyone wants to look at their work, it's It's fantastic and critical, hypercritical in a good way. Yeah. I think it's you know, it's such a challenge, and like it's hard to know. I mean, those two worldviews are so diametrically opposed, so incompatible that it's almost like it's hard to know how to go forward with that. And I think, you know, I tend to draw on the Gaswenta, which is a Haudenosaunee wampum belt, and that provides us with a very useful heuristic for self-determination and for living, mm-hmm. living alongside, incompatible worldviews and behaviors. And so, but it pictures it was originally meant to be the agreement between the Mohawks and the Dutch in what is now present day New York, and back to the 1600s. And so it depicts the Mohawks in their canoe going down the River of Life, and the Dutch in their boats going down the River of Life, not touching, but only collaborating in a kind of third space where items of mutual significance or issues of mutual mm-hmm. significance and interest arise. Right. And so, it's so hard to know, because I just think with harmful, exploitative, extractivist, capitalist approach. Sorry, again, that's a bit of a word salad, but that approach, it's like, you know, it doesn't leave a whole lot of room for live and let live. You know, like it's totalizing and it obliterates everything in its path. So I'm not quite sure that it's compatible with that Gaswenta ethic, or, you know.
Well, perhaps a way to sort of crystallize this interface and its problems would be to make mention of tobacco. Tobacco was used by indigenous people, as were many other plants like this, for very strictly controlled ceremonial purposes, which had mm-hmm. a community embedded purpose. They were not mm-hmm. they were not done in order to enhance your own personal mental capacities. And the Eurocentric capitalist, whatever you want to call it, approach mm-hmm. was to say, oh, that's great, let's bring some back to Europe, and everybody can start smoking tobacco. And then what do we have? We have an epidemic of lung disease and heart disease and cancer. And now the element that allowed us to say this isn't a good idea was that the health impacts, physical and or mental health impacts on people who became addicted through this industrial use of tobacco were manifest and now are changing everything. That's the health side. It is unhealthy. It makes people sick. It makes people suffer. It seems to me that that's a way that all of us, no matter what our origin or our belief system, when we start to feel sick, it is a way to waken us to a new way of thinking.
And you know, it's interesting that you bring up tobacco, and my fear is that same pattern. I mean, this is a centuries long relationship that Western Europeans have had tobacco, and it hasn't gone well. And I see it as kind of symbolic or emblematic, maybe as a better term, of the capitalist, global capitalist matrix in which we're all embedded. And I had this. I worry that the same will happen with psychedelics. And, I had this insight. It was almost came to me as a vision, like about a month ago or 2 months ago. And you're probably familiar with Trickster and all of the different indigenous Trickster tales. Yes. And so, Trickster shows up to disrupt our thinking and basically to instruct us in right livelihood and right living, right relations. And sometimes it's not pretty. And usually the way it goes is that, we learn something and then, change our behavior.
Keith, I'm going to have to cut in now because we're coming to the end of the show.
Sure.
But I would like to invite you to come back and talk with us more, because there are a lot of things that we've touched on that we can explore in more detail. And the notion of food, medicine, and consciousness alteration seems to me a very fruitful area to pursue. and your wealth of knowledge, and you have so many linkages to elements in our world that I think we need to explore further. So please accept that invitation, and we'll be speaking again. And thank you very much for being with us today. It's been a real treat and a most enjoyable experience for me, and I thank you for that.
Oh, likewise, Warren. It's a real pleasure to talk with you, and I'm happy to talk with you anytime. So thank you so much, and thank you for your kind words.
Not at all. It's in every way deserved. Thank you again.